You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis, windy, going to be rainy later. I don't know. It's a confusing day, Don.
Wait, you started with bright and sunny? Because I'm looking out the window, and I think the first element of a weather forecast is to look out the window and see what the actual weather is.
And it's right, cloudy. And I'm seeing sun on my redwood trees.
Are you? It's cloudy over here outside of Dixon. It was very foggy this morning, actually quite beautiful, with a dense valley, sort of a tule fog on our farm today. It is Wednesday, January 29th, as Lois and I are preparing this show for broadcast on Thursday, January 30th, 2025, and the temperature somewhere nearby here is 43 degrees. We've had some very interesting weather in the last week. Just before last week's show, we mentioned it had gotten below freezing, and I did double check, and the weather station nearest to my farm showed 26.5 degrees a week ago. Yeah, which is the coldest we've been, not just this winter, but we never even got that cold last winter. And then day before yesterday, it was 28 degrees. And yesterday morning, Tuesday morning, it was also 28 degrees. In fact, I think it was down in the 26 to 27 degree range out in the country. And we've had some distinct differences between in town and out of town with this cold, still weather we've been having under this ridge that's just been parked over us for the last 3+ weeks. We've been below 28 degrees, which can do some pretty significant damage to subtropical plants, things that we expect to be damaged, but which we hadn't been seeing that kind of injury on for the last, let's say, 3 or 4 winters. I have my Brugmansia, I think I talked about this last time, toasted. I mean, the foliage is completely dead. I know it will be fine, but I haven't seen that in quite a while. Some of my fuchsias and a lot of other things have been injured.
Now, you said there was a difference between out of town and in town.
Very much.
I'm assuming that that's because the air is still and all of the, well, warmth of the people and the houses they live in.
I'm not sure it's the people. Pavement, concrete, houses, yes, things like that.
And so if it's the air is still, then that warmth would huddle down over the city, right?
It's not just that, it's trees. I mean, things that even deciduous trees making a canopy over an area of branches can make a difference of a couple degrees. I'll see this on my own property where I'll walk out towards the meadow under the overhanging branches of walnut and pecan and oak and so forth, and then step out into the meadow and it's clearly, you know, 2, 3, 4 degrees colder. So in town, most people only got to 30, 31 degrees, which doesn't really do much damage. It's just that we haven't had that much of that this winter. But out in the outlying areas, we're seeing a significant difference in chilling hours. For example, if you go to the chilling hours updates at UC Davis weather station, or not weather station, the fruitsandnuts.ucdavis.edu site, we're getting plenty of chilling hours now. We were a little concerned there in late December, early January, because it had been relatively warm. It's been cold all through January now, and we're up over 600-something chilling hours in Davis. We're up close to 800 chilling hours outside of Dixon. There's a 100 to 200 chilling hour difference between outlying areas where the orchards are, where it matters, and in town. I'm not concerned about any fruit trees with respect to chilling hours if you've planted things that are appropriate to this region, but we were a little behind back at the beginning of January. Now we're beginning to catch up. Looks like we'll end the year in Davis 700 to 750 chilling hours, comfortably over 800 for the outlying areas. What matters? Well, Most of the varieties you're growing, if you bought them at a good local garden center, are in the 600 chilling hour range, and you'll have plenty. You'll have what you need. So I'm not concerned about it. But farmers, of course, people who grow crops for a living, would be concerned if we were below 800 because some of the fruit that are grown, Red Haven peach, Chandler walnut, are known to require higher chilling hours. They're getting what they need. And the main difference is I've never seen this big a disparity between chilling hours in town and chilling hours out in the country. I suspect that will be something we'll see more of going forward. Temperatures this week, well, we've got to change, not just temperatures. I don't think I've been able to say this for 4 weeks. We have rain in the forecast, ladies and gentlemen.
Rain, rain.
Remember
It says
that?
showers, Don. It doesn't say rain. It
Hey,
says showers.
we'll take whatever. So today is going to be 55, and tonight is going to be 34 with some more frost and fog. Thursday, the day of the broadcast, 56 with frost in the morning, then sunny. Thursday night is only going to drop down to 41 because we're going to get cloud cover, and then Thursday night, a chance of showers. Friday is only going to get to 52 degrees. But there's showers likely. The chance of precipitation Friday is 70% in our area. It's going to be higher as you go north. Friday night, showers with a low around 48 and a chance of precipitation 90%. Saturday showers. High is only going to be 56 degrees on Saturday. Chance of rain is 80%. Saturday night, showers likely, cloudy, and only going to drop, this is amazing, to 50 degrees. The low.
Wait a minute. The lowest, I thought the high was 50.
The high is 56 on Saturday,
The
the
low is
low is
50.
50 because of the cloud cover. Yeah. Sunday showers are very likely, mainly in the morning, then mostly cloudy the rest of the day with a high near 60. Sunday night, a chance of showers and only going to drop to 49. And Monday, a chance of showers, 58 degrees. Monday night showers, cloudy with a low about 45. Different weather sites are giving very different likely outcomes, but the Weather Service has given really good detail on this. The rain is mostly going north of us. Basically, north of I-80. And Lois and I were joking about this before the show. I'm north of I-80 by a few feet. She's
And
south
I'm
of
south of I-80 by half a mile.
Yeah. And so I'm going to get rain and you're not, apparently, according to
I
the
don't think
National
so.
Weather Service. This is mostly going north. The entire region will have chances of precipitation, says the Weather Service. The better chances and stronger moisture content will likely remain north of I-80 in the valley. Amazing what a difference a freeway makes. So the northern Sacramento Valley, southern Cascades, northern Sierra, and adjacent foothills stand the best chances of seeing precipitation. The pattern will remain flat on Saturday. Next, we'll talk about the snow briefly, says the very chatty National Weather Service extended discussion. This first system, well, it has trended higher in terms of total amount of moisture, will be quite warm in nature. Snow levels will begin at around 5,000 feet Friday and then climb to 7,500 feet on Saturday. So impacts appear to be minimal for travel and so forth, and roughly 1 to 3 inches of snow, locally higher, of course, along the peaks. The need for a snow advisory is not currently warranted. Lassen National Forest will likely see the bulk of the snow with the first system. Now we'll get into the extended we expected weather for next week.
They really are chatty,
They
aren't they?
are. They're just having a great time. There's been a change in the weather. It's been 4 weeks of just sunny, clear. They a little change. They get pretty excited over there. Ensembles, that's the models, continue to show trough, which means rain, continuing to influence our weather next week. The recent runs have brought it slightly further south, which has led to an increase in potential snow totals for the northern Sierra, southern Cascades, and the mountains of Shasta County. And the footprint of moisture has slightly increased across the region, with rain totals now reaching an inch or more into the Modesto area. For those of the out of the area, that's south of us. Another factor that is increasing confidence of an active pattern is the Extreme Forecast Index showing contours and some shift of tails over the northern Sacramento Valley. I see meteorologists getting excited here. Mountains for through Tuesday of next week. Snow levels look to remain at around 7,000 feet on Sunday, then drop into the 5,500 to 6,500 foot range. So there's a chance of 1 to 2 inches of rain, Northern California. Mostly north of us. The second system is going to push south a little bit. Main difference is we haven't seen rain, measurable rainfall here since the 2nd of January, and that was hardly anything. The day after Christmas was hardly anything. It's been almost a full month since we've had significant rainfall in the Sacramento Valley. Many conversations I've been having with people have been, should I water? And my answer has been, in many cases, yes, unfortunately, you should water. We got a week coming up where you don't need to water for two reasons. One, there's some rain in the forecast, and two, water use by plants will drop down very, very low with cloudy, foggy, and overcast weather. So nice change in the weather, and it looks like it's going to continue for a few days. Quick programming note, one listener said, the show on Saturday was different than the show on Thursday last week. I thought, that's interesting. I have no way to verify that or even know if it's possible. So I sent a note over to the station managers and they said, yes, there was a mistake. So if you have these kinds of things, bring them to our attention. DavisGardenShow@gmail.com is a great way to let us know if there's a problem with the podcast or in this case, the broadcast. I need to say this. They've just moved the studio in the station. The 5-year remodel is done. And the station moved, moved the studio from one side to the other. That was complicated. Phone lines, computer lines, all kinds of stuff had to be moved. And it was a heroic effort over the first couple of weeks of January to get everything in place. And there were a few minor glitches. So that is correct. But last Saturday's rebroadcast of the Davis Garden Show was a rerun from who knows when. And the Thursday show was correct.
So if you happen to listen to that Saturday show and went, oh, darn, I missed it. Hey, go to the radio station, kdrt.org, look for our show, the Davis Garden Show, and all of our shows for years are archived there. So if you missed one, or there was a glitch and it was the wrong one, or something happened to the radio station, it was off when we were supposed to be showing, just go to the radio station's archives.
They are there. Yeah, the public affairs shows, which is what we're called, archive forever. Music shows, you better grab them quick because that only stays up for 2 weeks. Speaking of shows, let's do a public service announcement. There's this show on KDRT called That's Life.
That's me.
And you interviewed someone who's been in Davis almost as long as you have.
Kevin Wolf. Yeah. Yes. And Kevin is... Well, if you've lived in Davis for very long, you probably know Kevin. He and I got together and we chatted about, well, a lot of history because we have a lot of history. And then we went on to talk about the new things. And for Kevin, he and his company, his new company, have designed a windmill, and it is a vertical propeller system.
So it is on Wednesdays.
At noon.
At noon. That's Life.
That's Life, noon Thursday. It'll be next week and the week after that his interview will be on. And it will be archived, of course, at kdrt.org.
And a quick correction to what you just said, it's noon Wednesday, not noon Thursday. Wednesday's at noon, That's Life. And so that would be February. Let me look at my calendar here. February, order sweet potatoes, order caladiums. Fifth, there it is. That's Don's calendar. Fifth, February 5th is an interview with Kevin Wolf about alternative energy sources such as wind. Yes, my calendar has things like order sweet potatoes. I order them in January, actually February, so that we have them ready for you in April. Order caladiums. I order them in February, so we have them available for you in May. That's the kind of calendar that a nursery guy has.
I have an exciting announcement for us. And this is from the University of California, the UC Davis Biodiversity Museum Day.
Yeah.
Now, the Arboretum is one of 11 units at the university that participates in this. It's going to be Saturday, February 8th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Go to the Arboretum and look at your events and read all this stuff. There's so much stuff happening that day at so many different places.
Yeah.
And it's a family affair. There are children's interactive exhibits and games and all this other stuff. And then there are tours. And I want to read two tours because this is really cool. The Waterway Enhancement Project Tour. You may have heard of us saying, oh, they're redoing stuff at the waterway. They are. And this is going to be a 30 to 40 minute walk around the reimagined Arboretum Waterway to learn about its new infrastructure to improve water quality and wildlife habitat. And this is led by Nina Suzuki, who is the waterway steward for the Arboretum.
Cool.
The other one that I want to announce is this one is called Aqua Free Garden. Explore climate resilient plants that flourish with little irrigation and learn sustainable gardening tips to conserve water while supporting local biodiversity. And this is led by Ryan Deering, who is a Gateway's horticulturalist.
Extremely knowledgeable, very good presenter. I think that'll be an outstanding tour.
Yeah. And there's more. So go check it out, get your times for the different things, and have a good time. I will try and be there.
And which date?
This is Saturday, February 8th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m.
At various places around UC Davis. So check out the maps before you head over there.
Right.
Okay, we have questions and comments. And let's see, the first thing is people keep coming in and asking me for potatoes. And I finally wanted to put my hands down on the table and say, it's January. It was 28 degrees yesterday morning. So let's
So
talk
you
about.
shouldn't plant. Well, the potatoes were underground. They won't
Let's
freeze.
discuss this briefly. Potatoes are pretty frost tender, frost hardy, excuse me. They're pretty adaptable plants. Think about the places that are famous for growing potatoes. Idaho. This is a place where frost can occur, I would imagine, even into June. The tops will be damaged if they've come up in warm soil and then we have a frost. So in general, we don't want to plant them when there's going to be a risk of frost in the within a few weeks of planting. So we generally plant potatoes here February. We're almost there. March is the more common time simply because of availability, and you can continue planting into April. The earlier you can get them planted, the bigger your harvest and the bigger your potatoes will be. So I have real, fervent potato customers. They're almost up there with the onion customers in terms of their intensity of devotion to this crop, who want to get them planted in February if they possibly can, because then they'll get early growth. If there's a frost, might do some damage. You might want to protect them, but usually isn't necessary here as we get further into February. February, not January, February. And they can get them going, especially if they have a raised planter bed or a special planter they've gotten for that purpose, because it'll tend to have warmer soil. So February is okay. March is great. You'll get a very good crop and good size, and you almost never have to worry about frost here in March. April works fine. And you can also plant potatoes into the early summer. Your yield will be different. The size will be different because they start to initiate the potatoes as soon as the plant starts to bloom, which simply happens more quickly as you plant later in the season. So there's no They're not late. We're all feeling like it's a gardening weather because it's January and sunny, but I would say February is better. And here's the other issue. Most of us don't really get our potatoes from our suppliers until February at the earliest. March is more typical. I have always had this back and forth with my providers on certified seed potatoes, which are certified disease-free, which is important. Yes, you could use a potato from the grocery store, but you'd have problems. We'll come back to that topic another time. But you want to get, if possible, certified disease-free potato starts. They call them seed potatoes, which is a little confusing. And they don't generally ship them until they know they won't have freezing weather where they come from. One of my suppliers is in
Idaho.
Eastern, well, one of them's in Eastern Washington, which might as well be Idaho, and the other one is in Indiana. So neither of those are like USDA Zone 9 or 10. I always tell them the same thing. We're ready for them in February. You ship them when you think it's safe. We'll take a gamble about some cold injury on the way because some percentage might be damaged if they get stuck in a UPS truck in a freeze or something. But issue is availability, and timing is a little early for putting them in January. They could be injured, they could rot, any of a number of things can go wrong. Raised beds are great for potatoes because then the soil warms up and you tend to get better results if you're doing this early planting. The other question that comes up, of course, is can I buy one at the store and plant it? Potatoes at the store have often been treated with a growth inhibitor, which will delay them from sprouting for a few weeks so you don't gain much. And they're not certified disease free. If you look at potatoes as you're buying them, you can often see, especially if you've taken a course in plant pathology, you can see points on those potatoes that will just rot in the ground. I mean, they're not completely free of diseases, and you could be asking for trouble. It might work, might not, but the inhibitor is the biggest issue. Organically certified organic potatoes presumably would not have been treated with that particular growth inhibitor, so they would be likelier to sprout. Or you can just buy some, set them on the counter, wait till they sprout, then plant them. That works. You do still have that disease risk.
Well, it is January and it's 2025, but let's look at some of the lessons that we got learned from 2024 in the garden. And Don sent me a little list. I love this first one. 24-pound watermelon is too big for most people.
Yes, these are
I mean,
notes.
how in the world would you even pick it up?
These are notes from last year's vegetable garden that I made as we went along, and just thought a couple of them might be useful for you folks. We grew a lot of watermelons this year. We put in eight plantings, eight hills of watermelons. And one variety in particular, the average fruit on it was 20 pounds, and a couple of them weighed in at 24 pounds. If you've got a big extended family, that's great. If you're a normal person with just a couple people in the household, it takes a long time to get through a 24-pound watermelon. Definitely something you should take to work with a bunch of plates and napkins and have everybody share it all at once. My focus this year is going to be on trying the newer, smaller watermelon varieties, what they're calling the single-serving melons. These have become a big deal in the seed catalogs, and I'm going through a bunch of them because I think this is really great for a lot of people. I mean, cantaloupe is a good example, muskmelon. The Charente is intensely fragrant. Many people find the scent of muskmelons a little overpowering, actually. Very sweet, rich-flavored muskmelon that fits in your hand. It's the size of a croquet ball. Does that help? How about a softball? It's the size of a softball. So you can cut it in half and scoop out the seed, and one person would logically eat one of these. They're calling them single-serving melons. Yes.
So, does that mean that instead of a 24-pound melon, I'll get 24 1-pound melons?
You'll get several. You won't get 24 of them, but you'll get several. And they are productive. And the other advantage of these single-serving melons, particularly in the case of Charente, but I'm going to try it with my regular watermelons this year, you can train them up on a tomato cage.
Ooh.
You can hang a 1 or 2 pound fruit. You can't hang a 24-pound fruit. It's going to fall down at some point, and then that won't end well. But these single-serving melons are certainly worth looking into. There's some watermelons out there that are only 5 pounds. The Sugar Baby, which I really tout for gardeners who come into my nursery and want to grow a watermelon and have never grown a watermelon before. Sugar Baby is one that I mentioned because it's a tighter growing. They call it a bush form. Simply has shorter internode distances, so the vine doesn't get as big. And the fruit are, 10 pounds. Great. 10-pound watermelon, 3 or 4 people can handle that. That's great. 24-pound watermelon, you better have an extended family or be having a barbecue. So that was the
Or
first one.
juice it,
Or
juice it.
yeah, there you go. I actually know people who even like dehydrate them, but it's a lot of watermelon to deal with all at once. And I will say this other thing about watermelons. Modern hybrids, the newer they are, the better they are. This is a case where old heirloom varieties have grainy texture, aren't as sweet, they're not as actually as pleasant to eat. I recommend, if you have room, and I've done this, try one of the heirloom ones like Moon and Stars, which has been around for 100 years plus, and then try a new one like Sangria, which was the 24-pound watermelon, and do them both. And I think you'll see the difference. The old ones are fine and they're very pleasant, but the new ones really have a crisper texture and are sweeter. So it's a case where the newer hybrids are actually an improvement. I'm going to be trying out those smaller fruited single-serving watermelons for you. I'll let you know. I will tell you this: I've given up on seedless watermelons. I'm not going to ever try and grow them again. They're weak plants. They don't yield well. You have to have the pollinizer. It's just a hassle. Just leave that to the farmers. They're doing a great job on it. You can grow your own seedy watermelon, so you can show your kids, "Hey, kids, this is what watermelons used to be like. Now you go outside and eat that." Kids today aren't going to know what they're missing without watermelon seeds. Do we sound old, Lois? Okay, let's go on to the next one on my short list here of
Okay.
lessons from 2024.
His lesson said, watch the ET rates and adjust your watering accordingly.
Absolutely. And this isn't just vegetable gardens. This was across the board. We always mention the sites where you can go to, like the Cimis. CIMIS weather stations that literally tell you hour by hour what the water use is. We try to give you guidance on what a fairly typical week is, a typical day is here in the summer. And this year, in July 2024, last year, July 2024, ET rates were anywhere from 10 to 30% above average pretty much all month. And that's not how averages are supposed to work, right? But there are only 3 days in the month or something like that where we were average high temperature. We were not below average at all. The entire month was essentially three back-to-back heat waves. And we had many, many conversations with people at the time and on the show, but also still continuing to discuss issues that came from this. If you were watering correctly, it wasn't enough. This is what I've taken to saying. If you were watering by, what we usually would tell you to do in terms of depth and frequency, it wasn't enough water. You needed to increase the duration primarily. Water longer when it's hotter. I know that seems intuitive, but when it's going on, July is hot here. This is normal. We hit 100 plus degrees several times in July in a normal summer. We also have days in the upper 80s and low 90s in a typical July, and we didn't really have that this year. So water use was above average, and well, that was affecting the woody plants on your property, the trees, some fruit trees, the ripening was affected and so forth. What it really affected affected was the vegetable garden. And that the main reason people didn't get great yields on some things like their tomatoes was they weren't watering deeply enough. So the key is to know the weather sites to go to. Of course, you can listen to the Davis Garden Show and we'll keep you posted on unusually high water use periods, but know those episodes when they happen. And if we're not getting those cooling spells in between, you may have to increase your duration. I'd rather have you do that than increase the frequency. So that's the key take-home lesson from the rather hot July of 2024.
Well, actually, there is another one, and I'm not sure if it's unique to 2024, but this note says green beans do best early and late in the season, but not during the July heat. Is that for every year or just was it?
Increasingly, but it definitely was true this year. Someone sent me a question a few months back about how has the weather changed in your area? Someone who went to school here exactly when I did, 1975 to 80, roughly. And he remembers the hot summers we had and the cold spells and the fog and all that stuff. And then he's moved to the Bay Area. He was curious, how has weather changed and what impacts has it had? It was just a casual conversation back and forth. And I said, well, some things that used to be easier to grow in the vegetable garden are not as easy as they used to be. I would say bell peppers and green beans are the two in particular. Bell peppers, we get way more summer scorch on the fruit. People are finding they need to shade them lightly. Other peppers are fine, but it seems like bell peppers are just more and more challenging. And green beans, they like the intermediate temperature range. Green beans don't like freezing weather, but they're pretty tolerant of cold soil. They definitely don't like hot weather in terms of yield. They'll grow fine. They're very vigorous vines. They're flowering heavily. And if you planted them in May, as I typically have done over many, many years, you should be getting beans in early July. Well, the flowers don't pollinate properly if it's hot. So if we get hot in mid to late June, you're just not going to get fruit on your green beans. You'll get aphids, you'll get flowers, you'll get lots of leaves, but you won't get much in the way of actual beans July and August. So what I am finding myself is that green beans are one of the earliest things to plant. They do well if you plant them in late March, very commonly, if the soil's warming up and we're sunny. And then you're harvesting on those in May and June, and then they're done. Take them out or use bush beans. That's actually what I've gone to. And then a late planting, and I learned this from an old timer here way back when we first opened. She came in August looking for seeds of Kentucky Wonder beans. And I said, smug little guy that I was, well, we don't really recommend Kentucky Wonder here because it doesn't take the heat. And she looked at me. She was in her 70s. And this was in the 1980s. She'd been here for a while. And she said, I always plant Kentucky Wonder in August because I get plenty of beans in October for the Thanksgiving dinner table. So I learned that from her, that planting in July and August works as long as you keep them watered, you know, really obviously water the young seedlings really well. I get great results. She was absolutely right. Listen to these old timers every now and then. She grew up here. She knew the climate, at least back then. And she was even then telling me something that I've found to be more and more true, which is that midsummer production from green beans in general is not great. Now, if you're growing beans for drying, that kind of bean, summer growth is fine. They'll continue growing. They'll flower. They'll set a little bit later. You're going to let them dry on the vine. That's okay. That's a totally different thing. And I've gone over to bush beans, which I can just stick a few of here and there around other things. And I do a bunch of them late in the summer and I always get good results from it. So little tip there from the 2024 season and before, and from a nice old lady from 1982.
Are there other beans that you would recommend for that might in the future be better for us in our climate?
Well, beans for, you know, cooking, drying, those kinds of beans do very, very well. And in fact, they're grown commercially around here. And if you're into that kind of thing, this is a great place to grow the kind of beans, white beans, kidney beans, red beans that we use in soups and stews and things like that. They're grown commercially here and sold all over the world. They do very well here because they don't mind the heat as much as the green beans. We're not aiming for tender, crisp, snappy, you know, beans. We don't care what happens to them. And they dry beautifully here. Anything that wants to have low humidity when it's drying, we're the perfect place for that. I guarantee we're going to have low humidity July and August with no problem. And there have always been farmers locally growing Canario beans and a bunch of other kinds for sale out of state. It's a very good climate for those. And that's an interesting group of vegetables to get into because there's a lot of heirloom beans out there. Seed Savers Exchange and some of the other longtime purveyors have lots of interesting beans. And if you're thinking about growing some of those, you're in a perfect place for it in the Sacramento Valley.
I wanted to have you talk about fruit tree training.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean, how do you prune it to get the best fruit crop for a backyard production? So I have heard of three different training styles, I guess to say, vase pruning, or sometimes called open vase pruning. And then there's the central leader pruning, and then there's a modified central leader pruning. So can you describe first the vase pruning, and would it be good or bad, or why would I want it or not want it?
Well, some of these things actually apply to ornamental plants that might be in your yard as well. Actually, I'm going to start with central leader. That's like the normal way a tree grows. All right. So that's like a shade tree. You allow the leader to grow. You don't take out the center of the tree because you want a great big shade tree. Why would you not do that with a fruit tree? You could get more
Well,
fruit that way.
I
You
can't get up there.
Well, yes, for your own safety and for the fact that a fully grown fruit tree of almost any type, trained that way, will produce hundreds, if not thousands, of fruit, which will then fall down, or you'll get up on a ladder foolishly and try to pick them. So one of the main purposes of training trees is to keep the fruit within reach and to reduce the fruit load so that you aren't getting broken branches and to improve the size and quality of the fruit. So we don't do central leader training on fruit trees, although we do that with shade trees. Then there are two options: vase training or open center training and modified central leader. I am a very strong proponent of modified central leader training. That is where I plant a fruit tree. I just planted a few new ones here. I can't help myself. And I plant them and I don't do anything. I cut off broken stuff when I plant them. Other than that, I leave them as they are. I stake them if they need it. They usually don't need staking, interestingly, because they're well branched and well grown. And I plant them and I do put a trunk guard on them to protect them from sunburn. That's really, really, really important to protect the trunk from sunburn. And I let them grow the first season. Then I look at my nice, healthy young tree that's put on 2 to 3 feet of growth during the first summer. I generally take the center out, but I don't take it way down like you see done with vase training or open training. And a lot of orchards are managed that way. I take it down to about 5 to 6 feet to an existing lateral branch. Then I choose 2 to 3 more branches further down the trunk, preferably at least a foot apart down the trunk, pointing away from each other. Obviously, you want them to grow away from each other. If there are two at the same point on the trunk, one of them's got to go because that's structurally unsound. And when I'm choosing, when I do that, I hope this is making sense. Of course, an illustration is helpful. But when I do that, I'm trying to choose what will be the permanent, or as they call them in the biz, scaffold limbs of the tree. And I want them at least a foot apart so that they're, if one of them, let's say one of them gets too much fruit and breaks, then it's just that branch that's broken. I haven't lost a third of the tree. I've just lost one of the branches. So I prefer to have well-placed scaffold limbs a foot apart up the stem, pointing away from each other, preferably about three of them, with a tree initially topped down to the highest one about 6 foot above ground. That way, I can keep that tree easily under 10 feet or under 12 feet, depending on what it is. The other technique is sometimes forced on you. You go to a nursery and you buy a fruit tree. This happened the very first one I purchased when I was a teenager. And you pay for it, and the guy wraps it up, and then he takes out his pruners and he cuts it in half, which horrified me. And he explained to me a bunch of reasons, which I now know to have not been valid. But this was standard practice for years and years and years. You would just cut it back to about 36 inches, let three branches come out at the point of the cut. And that's your new tree. And it now has a vase shape or an open center form. Has some advantages. You can easily keep that tree 8 feet or lower if you do some summer pruning and you train it correctly. All the fruit will be at picking level. But if you don't thin fruit, if you don't manage fruit load carefully, a whole branch will split out. And when it splits out, it splits right down to the trunk, right down to the main stem of the tree. Usually you lose the tree at that point. It's just not something you can save. So I consider that the vase training technique has some advantages, but in my opinion, rather major disadvantages. But if you bought a tree and it's been headed back, congratulations, you're now going to do a vase or open training technique. That means you have to be very vigilant about your future pruning and your future fruit reduction. You get a heavy fruit set year, like many people had 2 years ago, branches will start splitting out.
So in that thing where they cut it in half, all of your branches are going to be squished together, aren't they? I mean, they're
Yes.
not going to be 2 or 3 feet apart.
Correct. And I consider that structurally unsound.
So
But it is. But no, when we planted our almond orchard, the grower we bought the several hundred trees from told us to cut them all off at 36 inches. And I contacted, this is the old days before the internet, so I contacted someone over in the pomology department, one of my old professors, or extension guy, and I said, this doesn't correspond to what I've learned in horticulture. What we learn in horticulture, leave as much of the top as possible. The more leaves you have on your new tree, the stronger the roots will get, because leaves feed roots. And so it's better to leave it and not cut it back hard. Cutting it back hard stunts it technically. And he goes, yeah, that's true. We do it anyway. And I said, okay, what's the rationale? He said, for uniform branch structure and ease of orchard operations. Okay. So, and also it's only going to live for about 20 years. The expected lifespan of a fruit tree in an orchard is 15, 20, 25 years, depending on the species. So they're not worried about the fact that a branch may break out. They're not worried about the fact that it may be structurally somewhat unsound in the long run. Fruit trees are a production unit, and they have a shorter lifespan than perhaps most people are thinking when they plant a fruit tree. He agreed with me that it does technically stunt the plant a little bit, but they just want to start uniform orchard structure and make operations easier. Okay, so that's what we did. We cut them all off at about 36 inches. And they all branched out from that point. We did some thinning and training. But yes, indeed, as time went by, a branch would break, or you know, the tree would fall apart. You just take that out and plant another one. That's an orchard. I don't think that's the best way for home gardeners to go, but you will see this all the time. You'll see it recommended fairly regularly. Even local master gardener folks I have heard recommending this training technique. It's manageable. Just be aware that you've got to be vigilant about fruit load. And the two reasons for pruning a fruit tree are size control and managing fruit load. Those are the primary reasons for pruning a fruit tree. You just need to know where they fruit with respect to new wood, old wood, all those things we talked about at the beginning. It's a little complicated, but illustrations of modified central leader versus vase training will show you. You can find them online without any difficulty. One of the best resources that I suggest you spend a little time at, Fair Oaks Community Garden, which is out at on Zinfandel in Sacramento. You can go there during their open garden events. You can only tour the fruit producing part when they're, you know, the orchard part when they're having one of their open house events. But you can also go online to the Master Gardeners of Sacramento and find an amazing wealth of information from the Fair Oaks Community Garden demonstration orchards, demonstration vegetable gardens. They have three in one hole. They have trees planted as espalier. They have trees that are being pruned hard, trees illustrating summer pruning, and so forth. And it's really, there's some really good guides on there. Chuck Ingalls was a resident of Davis who was very, very influential in the development of that garden. Many of his works are on there. He's very knowledgeable about this. And it shows the different approaches. Some of them make more work for you. In my opinion, vase training requires more work than modified central leader training, but they both work. They've both been used for decades, if not centuries. And you just have to know what issues you've created for yourself by going in one particular direction. I mean, let's say you take a peach tree and you plant it. You don't train it at all. Let's say you use a central leader training on a peach tree. I can tell you exactly what will happen. 5 years in, that tree's going to fall apart. So you want to choose some kind of training and pruning technique. And a lot of backyard gardeners like to do a harder pruning approach. And okay, that's fine. Just be aware of, you know, the pluses and minuses.
Okay. I want to just tie into that modified central leader training. You said you let it grow the first year.
Or I do, yeah.
Second year.
I let it go. I plant it as it comes. It comes from the bare root supplier, and I let it grow for the first summer. Yeah.
Okay. And then you're going to cut it down to, you said 6 feet. What if I did 5 feet? That That's would be fine. Okay.
Actually, what I choose is an existing well-placed branch rather than 5, 6, 7 feet. I cut down to an existing branch if I possibly can. I'm not hitting it. I'm cutting to a lateral branch.
So won't that lateral branch try to become the new leader?
Yep. And with fruit trees, we are constantly removing leaders. Okay. Constantly. So, all fruit trees are managed. Remember our conversation about hormones a few weeks back? are cutting off those central leaders constantly with fruit trees. That's basically you're interrupting the plant's hormone relationship intentionally with fruit trees.
So if I stand in my house in a part of the house that has a normal ceiling, and I raise my arm, I can't touch the ceiling. Well, that ceiling's 8 feet tall. Mm-hmm. I cannot reach that.
Yep.
So I want to keep my brand new little fruit tree 8 feet tall.
Yeah.
So that I can reach everything. But yep. You said that if you, in your system, it's going to come down to 10 or 12 feet tall.
That's about
right. I want it at 8. How do I make it 8?
Summer pruning is a really important part of this. And that's, I want more and more people to adopt summer pruning, which you can Google just that term. Look for videos by Ed Livo of Dave Wilson Nursery. What that means is you've already taken it down to 6 feet or so when you put it in, or shorter if you're using the vase training technique. And then a bunch of growth comes on every season. Stone fruits are quite vigorous, especially on a good rootstock. And you go out there, they grow May, June into July, and then they're done. This goes for many ornamental plants that are not fruit trees as well. They have a deciduous plants often have a cycle of bloom. Then they go into what in pomology we were told was the quiescent period or summer dormancy. And if you cut them in, let's say you cut that new growth back in July, it may resprout and try and grow more. But if you do it in the 1st of August, it won't. So now we've got the season's growth done. You look at how tall it's gotten. It's now 10 feet. You don't want that. Just get out there and cut off everything that's taller than you want. As long as you know where it fruits and you know where the fruiting wood is, you can still do this. And this doesn't require any special horticultural training. You don't need a pomology expert to do this pruning. I had 15-year-old teenage males doing it on my property at one point. Said, here are the loppers. You're this tall. Reach up this high. Cut it all off. Well, like a hedge, Don? Yes, like a hedge. I'll clean it up later. Don't worry about it. You really don't have to worry about it. And there's really good illustrations of that on that website, the Fair Oaks Community Garden, showing plums and pluots before and after summer pruning. You're just shortening them up for size control. So that's just another step in the size control process. And I want to say this, summer pruning greatly reduces the amount of stuff you have to do in January. You're doing size control, pruning, shaping in August, and it's, you know, maybe hot out there, but you can go out in the morning. It's not muddy. It's not uncomfortable. The last couple weeks would have been pretty chilly to be out there doing major pruning on your fruit trees. January is not exactly the nicest time to be outside doing this kind of stuff. So let's do more of it in the summer and less in the winter. And this is a home gardener thing. You're not going to see orchards doing summer pruning. We're intentionally stunting the tree when we do this. If you take a course in plant physiology, you know, we're cutting off leaves in the summer. That's not good. They'd be feeding the root. They're, you know, that's energy being stored. That's correct. We are intentionally stunting the tree. You don't want the maximum yield potential of any fruit tree. 700 to 1,000 peaches is a lot to deal with in a 5 to 7 day span. So summer pruning will take care of your size control issue. You may wish to use a vase pruning technique. You may want to keep it even shorter. That's fine if you want to do that. Just be aware of the issues with that. But that's one of the main reasons for using the vase or open training technique, is it's easier to keep it down shorter if that's your preference.
So Don, we are recording this show the 29th of January. This is the end of January. Mm-hmm. We don't have any more days to go in January. And you know what? It's time to weed those stupid Velcro plants.
You're getting a little late. I hate to say this. All that sunny weather in January, they have gone now from 4 weeks ago, cute little seedlings that half a second with a hoe would have killed, to gearing up for the running across the ground stage. Some of them are already doing that because of how sunny it's been. If you get out there now, you can still chop them off with a hoe and get good results, or do whatever you prefer to do. Smother them, spray them, whatever method is okay with you. Hire somebody else to do it. Yes, there's another option. If you get moving quickly on that, you'll still get good control. 4 weeks from now, they'll be climbing up into things and flowering, and they'll break off as you pull them. They'll irritate your skin. So just a reminder, weeding is kind of an important job to do midwinter here in the Sacramento Valley. And some of the most difficult weeds, it's the only way you're going to get control, is getting out there now. I always get frustrated. People come in April, they're angry because these things have climbed all over everything. And they're, where did they come from? I said, well, good. I hate to say this, those sprouted in December. And that would have been a really easy time to take care of them. So if you want to make a garden calendar, December, January are really important times to manage weeds here in most parts of California.
So I am a Quaker, and I know the Quaker Meeting House at the corner of 4th and L, and we have work days, but they schedule them when it's good weather and it's warm, it's nice. And it's... So if anybody out there wants to go and weed the Velcro weed out of the Quaker Meeting House yard, I'm going to put out a call to them.
Seriously.
See if I can get anybody who's willing to go out there and pull a couple weeds.
But... Well, and remember, if you can't pull, chop, spray, you can bury. You know, this is simple. I say simple. How long did it take you to move that pile of our burst wood chips? Simple,
many months.
Simple in principle. You can bury them. You can smother them. I was just talking to someone about this yesterday. This whole carpet of weeds has come up, and he was, you know, trying to find cardboard and stuff like that. He was going to do the whole lasagna layering thing. I said, you know, just don't worry about that. Just bury them. Just smother them with get some arborist wood chips. And what I've done on my farm, this may not work in a residential setting. Your homeowners association may object to this one, but I've used a tarp with very good results. I have a 25 by 100 foot tarp. Paid a lot of money for it. It's very good for my purposes. A little bigger than you might be needing out there, but you
but
can
it's
find
thick it. And sturdy.
It is sturdy. Yes, I paid for a good one, and it has grommets so that you can actually anchor it down. And sometime in February, with help from at least one or two other people, we're going to unroll that tarp down an area that is presently a stand of winter grasses and mustard and things like that. And we'll have a lot of fun stomping those down as we roll it out. And then we will put things to hold it down. And if I do that in mid-February, by the first week of April, 6 weeks later, those weeds are dead. They're gone and they're composting under the tarp. We then have a really fun day pulling the tarp back because it's made this warm, moist environment. So having kids who are into biology really helped on this one. Dad, there's a bullfrog over here. Look, there's a whole family of field mice. Yeah, you'll find all kinds of critters under there. You'll also find a lot of very dead weeds. So February is a good time to start smothering those things that are in the place where you want to plant your summer vegetables in April and May.
So you stomp on things as you unroll it.
Oh, yeah, it's fun.
And when you roll it back up, you don't walk on it as you're rolling it. You start from the open end and slowly roll it so that you don't stomp on any mice or frogs or anything.
No, we try to be very careful not to hurt the woodland creatures.
How are your foxes doing today, Don?
Yeah, they're doing fine. I looked out my, if you follow me on Instagram, which you're welcome to do, is Don period Shore, Shor. I posted a four-part picture from last week where I looked out the window where the fox usually is, and there's a baby, well, an adolescent raccoon looking at me. And I came back a minute later, and there were two adolescent raccoons looking at me. And I came back a minute later, and there were three adolescent raccoons looking at me. And I came back a minute later, and there were four adolescent raccoons looking at me. I felt like I was in some sort of a Sesame Street skit, but I shooed them along their way, but I took some great pictures of them. So I deal with woodland creatures of all kinds here. I'd rather have foxes than raccoons in my backyard. Thank you.
Okay, so I have in front of me a list that is astonishing to me. It says woody plants that provide winter color in the landscape. And it's amazing. There's all these flowering woody plants and things with berries and things with colorful bark and wood and attractive fruit like the citrus and colorful foliage and very early flowering deciduous shrubs and trees. And it's huge. Don, is this on the website? Can people find this?
It will be shortly. And we talked about these a little bit back in December, things that were providing some color at that kind of difficult, gloomy time of year when we just don't have that much in the way of flowers going on. Now I realize when we say that here, there are people who are giving hollow, mirthless laughs in climates where it's
when the snow is 3 feet snow, tall.
Yeah, we don't have that here. But there are things that bloom in the winter here, and we've talked about a couple of them. There's a couple that I'd like to mention for now because people keep asking about them. Winter Daphne is a wonderful, wonderful plant that you will almost surely kill.
Winter Daphne.
It's just, the common name of Daphne odora is usually winter Daphne. You can call it sweet Daphne if you prefer. Winter Daphne because it blooms in the winter. And here it initiates buds in November, and you often have at least the beginnings of the flowers in December and January, February is when they're really in bloom. Intensely fragrant. And I always get people asking about it because there are some around the area. Once you've experienced the fragrance of Daphne, you certainly won't forget it. It's powerfully fragrant, the kind of spicy scent that almost makes your eyes water. It is extremely fussy about drainage. So it's one of those plants where I don't mind selling it, but I sure don't want you to think I'm guaranteeing it in any way. I've killed off four of them myself, and I'm going to plant another one because I'm a persistent gardener just like you guys are. It needs perfect drainage. What that means is you need to put it in a place where water always drains away from the crown. It needs to be crowned up, mounded up somehow. Raised planter is great if that works for you. And while they're reasonably drought tolerant, they can't take total drought. And they bloom best if they get some sun, but not full afternoon sun. And, you know, this is a fussy plant. And it's very, very easy to kill because it's susceptible to Phytophthora rot and just dies abruptly. I've killed them, as I say, four times by planting them, getting them established. I used rocks and things to make a higher point. And then I planted things in the same bed later, a year or two later, that needed water. And so I watered them and killed the Daphne. So put it in a place where you can back off on the irrigation, but not to the point of a very low water landscape. That's just all I'm going to say on Daphne because, you know, people love them, but they also are really easy to kill.
Sarcococca. I've got to say that word because I smelled it as I walked out yesterday.
Yeah, so if you want a fragrant plant for the winter that's incredibly easy to grow and doesn't need any sun at all and can take some drought but also can take watering, Sarcococca ruscifolia. Sweet Victorian box is the common name. It's not sure where the Victorian part comes from, but it looks kind of like a boxwood, and you can clip it like a boxwood if you wish to. And here it sets buds in late fall, and they open in the winter, and they're really little tiny flowers, but it's got that kind of fragrance that drifts around, and so you'll be walking by a hedge of it wondering where that wonderful sweet smell is coming from. So Sarcococca, there's nothing exciting about Sarcococca except that it will grow in total shade. There aren't that many plants that will, and it's fragrant.
My plant of Sarcococca seems to be not very robust. Do I need to fertilize it? Is it just not a robust plant?
It is a slow grower. I mean, 6 to 12 inches a year is pretty typical growth on Sarcococca. I had some that after 35 years had gotten 6 or 7 feet tall, but that took them that long to do it. So for the first decade, they were basically a 3-foot shrub. And it's a great little sort of background plant. Again, the foliage is dark green and shiny. You don't get excited about the look of it. And the flowers are very tiny, but they are powerfully fragrant. And it does set little berries as well, which are kind of pretty. So there are things that bloom in the winter. I wanted to lead into, what's that tree? Because it's the start of that seasonal question we get every single year as they start to come into bloom very early. The very first almonds are blooming in the Sacramento Valley. The seedling trees always seem to start before the orchard trees. The bee boxes are out along the orchards of almonds. They're out there stacked up, ready to go. So the almonds are blooming. Pyrus kawakami, which is sold in Southern California as evergreen pear. It's not really evergreen in Northern California, so we call it the kawakami pear. A lot of people think it's the Bradford pear or one of that group, Pyrus kalariana. It's not. It's a different species. Pyrus kawakami, K-A-W-A-K-A-M-I, first starts to bloom here in December. And heavy bloom in January and February, and it's finishing up when the other pears come into bloom. There are a fair number of them around Davis, some in the downtown area. Some of them have been planted where they also planted Kalariana or Bradford pears. Those are gone for the most part because they have all kinds of problems. Pyrus kawakami, hardly anyone's selling it anymore because of the leaf spot fungus that it gets and some susceptibility to fire blight. Neither of those things particularly hurt the vigor of the tree. And it does this midwinter bloom. It's got a nice growth habit. It's a little more rounded habit than the Kalariana pears. So you'd have to search for one if you really wanted it. But the main thing it has is this very, very early bloom. And the other one that's very close to bloom right now is the flowering plum, Prunus bleriana. This is one of the truly fruitless flowering plums. It has double pink flowers with the almonds. One of the very first of the flowering trees to bloom in this area does not set fruit. There are ornamental plums that have pretty flowers that set fruit. Don't plant those. If you want a nice early flowering tree, you want to draw the bees out a little early and get them out, you know, into your orchard before the other fruit trees have started. Prunus bleriana, usually simply sold as flowering plum, is just about to bloom right now. And in full bloom in my backyard is the flowering apricot, Prunus mumei. Prunus mumei is not an apricot like you're thinking of. It's not like a Blenheim apricot. It does set a fruit, which is not got great flavor, but is used for a salt curing technique in Japan and other places. And it blooms very, very early. There are some ornamental versions of Prunus mumei. Mumei, M-U-M-E. I believe there's at least one in a fairly visible part of the arboretum because people every year seem to come in with a picture of it and say, what is this? I want one. It's a double flowering apricot, blooms in January and February. So those are the first four introductions in our What's That Tree repeating program topic here.
When does the flowering quince flower? It seems like it should be pretty soon.
Mine are already blooming. Yes, those are shrub, not tree, but mine are already blooming. My Toyo Nishiki was in bloom actually on Christmas, and that frequently happens, but January is when they really start to come into bloom. And the flowering quince, Shinomaly japonica, is a popular ornamental shrub, very much more cold tolerant than we need to worry about here. So you can grow that in a lot of climates that are a lot colder than California. It's a great shrub. It doesn't sell most of the year, except in January, February, when it's blooming. It's another one that brings the bees out early, and you'll see them all over it on our property because they drop the bee boxes at the nearby almond orchards, and our flowering quince is the only thing blooming when they do. So all those bees come over to our farm. Interestingly, because of that, we sometimes get fruit on our flowering quince. Shinomaly japonica, some varieties do fruit. Like regular quince, it's a rock-hard fruit, but extremely aromatic, and it actually makes an excellent jam. So if you happen to have flowering quince, Shinomaly japonica, and you see the fruit form on them, take them. You'll have to cook them down, obviously, because they're just, you know, solidly rock-hard, but they make an amazingly aromatic and beautiful jam. So Shinomaly japonica is worth growing for the fruit, as well as these extremely early blooms.
So Don has this chart in front of me with all these plants, and the title is Woody Plants That Provide Winter Color in the Landscape. I am hoping that he's going to get that up on the website and y'all are going to be able to go and find it there, because there's a lot of plants that we didn't even get to talk about.
Yeah. Yep. And there's some of these things that are grown in much colder climates that I'm not that familiar with, like witch hazel, I gather, blooms in the winter. One that we can grow, that you can also grow in a lot of colder climates, is winter sweet, Chimonanthus praecox. And I have one of those, and mine is usually blooming around Christmas, and it smells like spice cake.
Is that a tree or a bush?
It's a large shrub that you could train up as a tree, but my customers from Persia know this one. They call it, I think they said, ice flower. And I believe it's grown back east in the United States as well, where it can be blooming with snow on the ground. It's one of those kind of things. Blooms very, very early. It's not a really showy flower. So you're walking by your hedgerow and suddenly you smell grandma's spice cake aroma coming out. It has a very cinnamony kind of spice smell.
Well, we always end with a garden quote. And today, my garden quote is a Chinese proverb.
Okay.
It says, all gardeners know better than any other gardener.
Yes. I have observed that it's best in a relationship if one of the two is a gardener. If they're both gardeners, there may be problems.
Okay, well, I was going to save this for next week, but I'm going to do this other garden quote.
Okay.
Jean-Jacques Rousseau is the author. I don't know who that is. Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. And the quote is, plant and your spouse plants with you. Weed and you weed alone.
There you go. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
On Na Mele o Hawaii, you can join host Beth Post as she features the unique sounds of Hawaiian music, from the early icons of island music to today's innovators, exploring styles, the history of the genre, and revered songs and performers. That's live Thursdays, 1 to 3 p.m. Na Mele o Hawaii replays during the week, so for the rebroadcast time, just click on the schedule guide.